This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, the seasons are changing. Fall's just around the corner. Yet the decisions on the legal challenges to health reform still remain the same, unchanged. The appellate court weighed in on the Affordable Care Act last week, affirming the administration's argument about the individual mandate being a tax and ruling that the plaintiffs lack standing.
And, you know, I think it's the start of our third year of this show, and that's a good tie to this is the third appellate court to voice its opinion this year. So it was back in June when the Sixth Circuit in Ohio ruled that the individual mandate was constitutional, and then in August, the 11th Circuit in Atlanta ruled it was not. And not to be outdone, the Federal District Court in Pennsylvania just struck down the individual mandate as unconstitutional. Is this going to end someplace?
I don't know if it will. Certainly, it's headed towards the Supreme Court. Who has the final say on this? It will be interesting to see when they decide to weigh in.
And we always remind each other and our readers that, you know, far beyond the contentious individual mandate, and much in the Affordable Care Act seems to be contentious these days, it's good to remember that the Affordable Care Act also had a big focus on job creation and on health information technology, both of which are potentially inspiring to our economy.
And while the president is traveling around the country trying to build support for his new job bills, he's also declared this week Health Information Technology Week.
That's right. And as part of Health Information Technology Week, the Health and Human Services Division of our government held a forum on Monday, and they announced some new rules expanding patients' rights to access their own health information. And as we have come to expect from the folks at HHS relative to health information technology, there were actually some exciting, dramatic moments in that, Mark.
There was. Todd Park, wild and crazy guy that he is, what energy he has. Many of the participants at the event were there to announce the Blue Button program. And the Blue Button program, which was announced last October, really got its groundbreaking kickoff at this event, with many organizations signing up in sort of a public display of unity.
And I think I heard Todd Park inciting United and Aetna insurance giants to compete with each other about how many millions of people they could get using that blue button to access their own health information. And right here in our community health center, we've also been encouraging our patients to sign up and use our patient portal so they can get their own health information. We look forward to more innovations in bringing our patients into the fold.
And certainly with Don Berwick at the head of CMS, we're certainly bound to get more focus in on patient access to health information as a cornerstone to improve quality and safety of our healthcare system.
And, you know, another way to approach quality, Mark, is through something that people still call patient satisfaction surveys, but I think we've started really thinking of them as understanding the patient experience. And our guest today, Dr. Cleary, has led many efforts over the years to increase our sophistication and our ability to use the experience of patients and tools that measure that to directly improve the quality of healthcare and our healthcare systems. Dr. Cleary is the Dean of the Yale School of Public Health and the Chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health at Yale.
You know, we're happy Dr. Cleary is with us today. We'd also like to welcome our new friends at WQUB-FM in Quincy, Illinois, who starts broadcasting Conversations this month. And for people who are listening to us and want to know more about us, go to Google and just type in CHC Radio, see what you find.
Welcome to our friends at WKUB. And as always, if you have feedback, email us. We love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Cleary, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. In its latest report, the Census Bureau released new data that indicates a rise in the number of uninsured Americans. The number rose to 49.9 million in 2010, up from 49 million in 2009. The percentage of uninsured, 16.3%, did not change. Also, despite the economic downturn, the percentage and number of people covered by Medicaid, 15.9% and 48.6%, did not change in 2010.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Paul Cleary, Dean at the Yale School of Public Health and Chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health. Welcome, Dean Cleary.
Thank you very much for having me.
Since the 1980s, you've been actively involved in research focusing on persons living with HIV, and as a sociologist, you investigated the ways in which HIV affected people's lives. You and your team have looked at physician and clinic characteristics to predict the quality that patients receive. I think it's fair to say that one word that keeps showing up in everything we read about you is quality. How do you define and measure the quality of care that patients receive, not just in the HIV space, but in medical care generally?
Well, as you can imagine, especially me being an academic, there are a lot of ways of defining quality, but a sort of a very simple heuristic I often use is that people should be getting the care that they need. People shouldn't get care that they don't need. And the care people do receive should be provided correctly and appropriately. So you and I should not receive a cardiac procedure we don't need. And you may say, well, that's a silly example, but it happens all the time. People who don't necessarily need certain procedures or activities receive them. What we're more familiar with is a lot of people don't receive what the care they need. So, for example, you mentioned I do a lot of work in HIV. Many people are not aware of their HIV status. Those who are don't get care and so on. And then the third part, of course, if any of us goes to the physician or the nurse or the clinician who's providing care, we'd like that care to be provided correctly. We'd like the right drugs, we'd like the right treatment, and so on, and like that have done appropriately. So that's obviously when you get down, the devil's in the details, and when you start doing studies, you try and get very, very precise measures, but those are the basic concepts. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Cleary, you're a founding member of the Picker Institute, which is a major force in promoting the idea that routinely monitoring the patient experience, and I emphasize that's the experience from the patient's view, is a critical element of quality assessment. And you've done some very important work in developing survey protocols for quality assessment and patient satisfaction as one strategy that might actually improve healthcare and thus health. So tell us a little bit about the state of the art and the science around measuring the patient's experience and how is that translating into practice and even into policy with some of our major programs like Medicare, if it is?
Sure. So you just asked me broadly about quality of care, and there's a lot of aspects of quality of care. I mentioned access and technical quality. You know, if you and I are getting a pharmaceutical, that should be the appropriate drug, it should be the appropriate dosage, and so on. But there's what we call one facet of quality is patient-centered care. Patients' care should meet their expectations and be appropriate, and patients should be treated with dignity and respect and so on. And there are a variety of aspects of care. So let me just stop there. So that's in addition to technical care. I think you and I, if we went to the doctor, we would think a quality interaction and the physician would think a quality interaction was a situation where we got the information we needed. We were treated with dignity and respect. We're given an opportunity to express our reasons for the appointment and so on. So that's how we think of quality of care. And then you say, well, how do you measure that? Well, there are a variety of aspects of care. I would argue, and I think almost most people would now agree with, that patients are the best and only source of information about the quality of care. So, for example, if you and I go to the doctor and someone says to the doctor, well, did you explain to them how to treat their hypertension? He says, oh, he or she might say, oh, I did a fabulous job. On the other hand, if they asked you or me, we might say, I got an explanation, but I didn't really understand it. So I am the only person who can say whether I was given information in a way that I understood, whether I was given an opportunity to express my needs, whether I was repeated with respect, and so on. So to get at that, as you mentioned, I was one of the founding members of the Picker Institute. We, at that time, this is an institute that was founded by Harvey Picker, was very concerned about the quality of the interpersonal aspects of care throughout the United States, began developing specific questions to ask patients to understand better their experiences. And I use the word experiences, not satisfaction, because there's a gazillion satisfaction surveys. But again, to cut to the chase, I could be satisfied with lousy care or dissatisfied with good care. What we tried to move towards was questions that get at specific experiences of things that should have happened or shouldn't have happened. So I just gave you one example. Were your questions answered in a way that you could understand? That might be a question we would ask.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Paul Cleary, Dean of the Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Cleary, we'd be a little remiss not to mention that you also received the Picker Award for Excellence in the Advancement of Patient-Centered Care. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
And you were recognized for your tireless effort to elicit patients' experience through well-designed surveys and success in demonstrating that quality patient experiences are linked to positive patient outcomes. Now, Margaret and I are particularly fascinated with this level of work, in part because we run a community health center where patients are at the core of the organizational design and delivery model. So pull the thread for us. Tell us who out there is translating this focus on patient-centered care into public health. Where do you see it happening? Where are the best practices?
You know, this is going to sound obvious, but one of the fundamental principles of quality improvement is you need to know what the quality is before you can improve it. And so getting the data out there, it's necessary, obviously not sufficient. We have to do many things after we get the data out there, but it's a necessary condition for this. And now that we have national data, it's just really very, very facilitative. And groups like CMS, various purchasers are both encouraging, for example, NCQA, through their efforts, they've made enormous impact on the quality of care through the United States by measuring and publicizing a variety of indicators of care quality in managed care plans. One of those indicators is the CAHPS survey. Different purchasers are using what they call pay-for-performance, so they're basing part of the reimbursement on their scores. Right now, for example, CMS has a program called value-based purchasing, where they're actually basing some of the reimbursement to hospitals on their CAP scores. So, you know, for example, I know people I've known for I know many people in the healthcare industry, as you might imagine, and they've known that I do these surveys for many years, and now, increasingly, I'll get a call. I'll be, Paul, you know, we always thought this was really important, but now that there's, and they won't say it quite this way, but now that there's money on the table, we're particularly interested. Now, you know, I should say my personal opinion is most providers, most of the time, provide superb care, and they're motivated more by professional norms and goals and their own standards than money. But the point is, there's a lot of levers now and tools out there for trying to improve the patient experience.
And we have certainly learned an amazing amount and continue to through ongoing surveying of our own patients' experiences. So we appreciate your leadership in this field. I'd like to turn to the issue of community engagement, if you will. Dr. Cleary, during your tenure as dean of the Yale University School of Public Health, you've certainly made community engagement an issue for the school and the university. And I think it's fair to say that historically there's been tensions in some urban centers that are home to major academic institutions where the local residents may feel they're often the focus of the study but not the beneficiaries of the outcomes of the research. So tell us a little bit how you've made research and interventions available to your New Haven, Connecticut community and your goal of being a good neighbor. And I'd be particularly interested in hearing a little bit, if you will, about the Community Alliance for Research and Engagement or the CARE Initiative.
Sure. Let me just quickly say, not only is that a fair statement that there's not an often an ideal relationship, but I think it's sadly very, very common. And some of the first meetings I went to when I became dean here was with community groups, with individuals in the community. And there was quite a bit of tension. And they said things like, well, you know, Yale once did a study, and we never even heard the results of it. And so not only did the study not contribute to the community, people didn't even have the courtesy of letting them know what had happened. And I often summarize the School of Public Health mission as research, education, and service. And I think we're best at providing service based on the research we do. That's what we're really good at. We learn about prevention and about healthcare, and that's what we can translate most effectively. And I just very, very early on tried to make it clear that we have a moral obligation to really communities throughout the world to translate some of what we know into better health. We have, as I say, programs throughout the world, but of course our closest neighbors are New Haven residents. And I often sort of said, just to be provocative, that if when my term of dean was ended, New Haven was not healthier than it was when I got here, everyone in the university should consider my tenure a failure. And I remember President Levin looking at me and I said, well, you know, you might not succeed at that, right? And we sort of laughed. And I said, well, of course, that's a hard task, but I think we should set that kind of goal. And you mentioned CARE, the Community Alliance for Research Engagement. One of the reasons I think academic institutions don't do as much as they should or as well as they should with respect to the communities is it's not their normal routine. It's hard to have what we call a sustainable program. You know, you go out and do one study, the grant ends, and in fairness to the investigator, the money's gone, you have to move on to the next project and so on. So it seemed to me one of the fundamentals for making this a better relationship was to have an ongoing relationship, not study A and study B and study C, but to develop a relationship where there was engagement, where you could consider research and so on.
But in addition to training leaders to make significant contributions to global health research, you're personally are recognized for your work with students to develop their interest and skills in health and health service research. What leaves you optimistic about the next generation of public health professionals and healthcare providers?
Well, there's two levels of answer to that. One is just sort of my experience of the field of healthcare. So we were talking about patient-centered care before. We were talking about quality measures. I've been in this field long enough such that I remember when you would have a discussion with a group that you had an idea about measuring quality of care, that people would sort of look at you almost like, well, who do you think you are that you can define quality of care? We know what quality of care is. Virtually no one reacts that way now. It's just part of it's in the air. It's part of the culture that there are quality problems, that people make errors, and that we need to improve those. So that's a dramatic improvement. When I first started doing patient-centered care, people would look at you like, well, that's not serious. And I'll give you one very, the first national survey we did at the Picker Institute of patient experiences of care, I was very excited. We got funds to do a national survey. It was the first time we'd looked at this issue nationally and submitted it to a very prestigious journal and didn't get into that. Eventually got into health affairs, but didn't get into the first journal. I'll never forget, two separate reviewers said, our job is to get patients out of the hospital alive. This is not, basically this is not important.
It's a low bar.
And now it's just, my phone literally rings off the hook. I could, people are constantly trying to measure and improve care. So that's the environment. Why am I optimistic? I'm incredibly optimistic. There's been a sea change. There's so much interest in quality. Groups like CMS are now launching initiatives and, have financial incentives. Purchasers care about it, et cetera, et cetera. And the Affordable Care Act, finally, after decades and decades of, trying to get some kind of comprehensive insurance program, people are insured. We can address the basics and move on. So that's the sort of the system answer. But you asked about the people, and all I can tell you, people often ask me, what's the worst part of your job and what's the best part of your job? I'll say there's no bad parts of my job. But the best part of my job, the answer always comes almost instantaneously. It's the students. Mm-hmm. And people sort of look at me because, students require attention. Sometimes they have issues that need to be addressed. And so I said, why do you say that? And I said, the students I meet, virtually to a person, are just incredibly bright. They are incredibly motivated. They're creative. It just boggles my mind. They go off and do internships throughout the world. They come back. And, you know, in these days, it's very easy to become cynical, especially when we're talking about sort of the disparities in income, which I think are unconscionable right now. Basically, every student in our school has decided to pursue a profession where it's almost certain their income will be less than innumerable other professions they could have pursued. These are really, really smart, really, really motivated students. And they're really motivated to make a difference. So when you, when I have the opportunity to meet with those students every year and see how smart they are, how motivated they are, how creative they are, I just have almost unlimited optimism. And that's one of the things I tell them every year at commencement. You know, that's, I say, the best day of my year is commencement, because I see those students, I see their parents, I see the, and, you know, I go around the country, so I see our alumni. Mm-hmm. I see them in China and Russia and Brazil and South America, you know, other parts of South America and Canada and the United States. I see them in rural towns and cities, and they're just doing incredible work. So when you, when your job is interacting with people like that, I just can't help but be optimistic.
Well, Dr. Cleary, we share your optimism about the next generation. And, you know, speaking of their creativity, we have one final question we'd like to ask all of our guests. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation? And who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
The change that I'm seeing now is the, maybe this is not what you're asking about in terms of innovation, but in the past, we used to do study X and study Y, whether it was biomedical or social science or whatever. The change now is that people are starting to think about broad systems of care. In other words, you can't just go into a community health center like you have and tell the nurses to do X in terms of answering questions. You really need to think about the whole community health center. And similarly, in New Haven, you can't just go in and launch a new HIV screening program. You need to think about how's the neighborhood affecting that, how are individuals affected, how are the policies affected, and so on. So the innovation, if you will, and I don't think this is what you're asking, but I'll answer it anyway, the innovation is really thinking about broad systems. So, for example, the head of our global health initiative, Betsy Bradley, is working in several countries throughout the world. Recently, she launched a program in Ethiopia where she was working with everyone from the Minister of Health on down to nurses in hospitals, really transformed the way hospitals were managed to rethink how they were approaching it. And so I think that was so successful. She was asked by the Clinton Foundation to go to Liberia. And so what's different there is it's really a very comprehensive approach where you're thinking about the entire system and the multiple facets that affect this.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Paul Cleary, Dean at the Yale School of Public Health and Chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health. Dr. Cleary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about these issues.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on an initiative that could change the way we think about delivering preventative care. In 2007, Dr. Bert Peterson, a prominent New York cancer surgeon, approached leaders at his Harlem church about creating a program to address health disparities affecting African American men in Harlem. As a champion of the underprivileged, Dr. Peterson wanted to do something about the fact that African American men, especially those living in urban areas, disproportionately suffer from many chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. Dr. Peterson's church, the Abyssinian Baptist Church, also Harlem's largest, took action. It partnered with Harlem Hospital Center and St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital to launch the Barbershop Quartet. Mobile medical units staffed by medical professionals park outside different Harlem neighborhood barbershops on Saturdays during the spring and summer months. Men from the barbershop or from off the street come in and receive free screening for diabetes, hypertension, and prostate and colon cancers. It's first come, first serve, with no eligibility requirements. Men also receive free education about the screening and follow-up care if needed. Program staff follow up by phone with the results, and St. Luke's provides free treatment if the person can't afford it. According to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the program has increased access to needed screening and treatment since it began 5 years ago. Targeting preventative health care to a minority population in the context of the community, no, that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.